Thank you, Mr. Crystal. One of my friends and neighbors in Crawfordsville, Indiana, is a nationally known cartoonist. And in a recent cartoon of his on the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, he put into the mouth of one of his speakers, of one of his characters, a statement not unlike the statement of the dilemma of Mr. Crystal, as he defined it here. He had this one middle-aged businessman type saying to another, "Every time I take a firm stand these days, I find myself in with a lot of people I don't like." And I think this is the dilemma. I think with you, it's often with many ideas you do not like, whether the people themselves are charming or no. Our next speaker is a true Renaissance man, listed in Who's Who as educator, psychoanalyst, author. His memberships include the Royal Economic Society. Oh, I'm sorry. Who speaks second?
I've been looking for a few speaking up.
Ernest wants to make a synthesis.
Like, let me be a Renaissance man, I'd be a Baroque. I mean,
that's a free enterprise.
Thank you. But Milton's mind works very slowly, and I wanted him to have adequate time to prepare an answer. All right, I'm the last. It's always the moderator who's last to know here. And introducing Milton Friedman.
The Renaissance man.
He is a Renaissance man. He is indeed. I want to tell you an absolutely true story from this last summer. I was lecturing at the banking school at the University of Wisconsin, and my first lecture was to be delivered on the morning of the very early morning explosion on the campus in which the scientist was killed. And my lecture was to be given in the School of Commerce building, just less than a block away from the explosion site. And this building, too, suffered some damage. So that when we finally were able to get to that building, we found that the room in which we were to work had a ceiling that did not look too stable. But some of the building engineers assured us that it would survive without any problem. And so I went ahead, and at the very end of my lecture, in the final summation, so help me, as I came to the name of our patron saint, I had no more than said the two words Milton Friedman when one-third of the ceiling came down on the audience. I had known you were not popular in Madison, Milton. Had I thought I would have said something more reassuring to the ceiling, Richard Ely, John R. Commons, perhaps even Walter Heller, but I made the mistake of saying Milton Friedman. We can assume Milton is somewhat more popular in Chicago, but if you hear any creaking from above, take to the hallways would be my advice. By the way, if Friedman has a tendency and affinity to hopeless causes, this seems to go with the name. Witness the man now running against Daley for mayor here in the city of Chicago, Milton Friedman.
Aspects which are wise, temperate, judicious, and urbane from those which I do not agree with, which is, of course, the only definition anybody has of being wrong, of the other man being wrong. I may say, so far as my own designation as conservative or liberal, I got a letter the other day from a woman somewhere near Massachusetts who wrote, or maybe it was a man, I'm not sure, but the letter went, "My son has been required to read your book in class, has been compelled to read your book in Capitalism and Freedom in class, and he has decided that you're a quack, but I think you're just confused." Needless to say, this letter might have come from either the left or the right, but it did come, to judge from the enclosures, which were from American Opinion, it did come from the right. The writer thought I was a collectivist and a socialist of the worst kind, so I'm delighted to have Irving refurbish my credentials as a conservative libertarian or a libertarian conservative or something. I must say, personally, I don't like those terms at all. And how confusing they are is nowhere better shown, I think, than in the recent debate about the SST. This was a beautiful example. Here was a proposal that you have a socialistic activity, namely government subsidization and sponsorship of the manufacturing of an industrial item, namely an airplane. Who was voting for it in Congress? All the defenders of free enterprise and of the all the opponents of socialism. Who was voting against the government subsidy of the SST? For the most part, all of the socialists. The ideological distribution of the votes was precisely the reverse of the ideological content of the issue. And I think this is very revealing in terms of the confusion which there is about ideology and the extent to which the people who talk about being in favor of free enterprise and opposed to socialism don't really mean that. They really mean that they are in favor of a particular collection of objectives like a strong air force or an anti-communist stand. And the people who are on the other side aren't really either consistently socialist either. They, again, to them, socialism is not an ideological stance so much as it is an excuse for a particular activity. So I do think that the terminology is very confused and very confused today. One of the things that that produces a confusion of terminology is that there is an intellectual temper of the time which tends to infect everyone and which it is almost impossible for anybody to stay clear of. The businessman, the Soames, Soames' fourth wife that Irving was referring to, he was reflecting in his discussion, if it had been held at that time, he was reflecting the intellectual views that were dominant of his time, and he was not unaffected by John Stuart Mill or Jeremy Bentham or the other philosophical radicals whom Irving would have regarded as not really in with the bourgeois ethic of the time. And the businessman today who speaks about activities is also being affected by today's intellectual climate of opinion. He is reflecting the fact that the climate of opinion today is almost wholly collectivist and socialist, and therefore the businessman who thinks he's talking in the name of free enterprise is 9 times out of 10 talking socialism. And my main reaction to the very wise and profound comments that Irving Kristol made is that I thought that in part his comments reflected on a much more sophisticated and subtle way the same phenomenon, the extent to which he was really reflecting and treating as a necessary part and consequence of a free enterprise society and a free society, he was attributing to that what are really the consequences of an intellectual view that is wholly hostile to a free enterprise world and a free society. Let me be a bit more specific. I think we have all been aware over a long period of time that time after and again, difficulties in our society, which are really attributable to mistakes in governmental policy, have been treated as being essential characteristics of a free enterprise system or of a business system. So the Great Depression from 1929 to 1933 was and still is widely regarded as a sign of the instability of a private enterprise system, instead of being regarded, as it should be, as a sign of the instability of government management of money. Well, now, Irving brought out an idea that I had never seen heard of before, and I think is extremely ingenious, of a triangle of economic collectivism, personal liberty, and material hedonism. And he argued, essentially, that he thought you could have economic collectivism and personal liberty if it was built on a foundation of religious faith, so that what people wanted to use their liberty for was to be like everybody else. That's a little bit of an exaggeration, but it gets the right flavor of it. And he treated these three things, economic collectivism, material hedonism, and personal liberty, as if they were somehow three unrelated strands, as if the material hedonism had developed out of philosophical attitudes in the society which were not themselves related to the economic collectivism on the one hand or personal liberty on the other. And I would argue that the situation is very different, that the material hedonism which he objects to is that it is in and of itself in large part a manifestation of the economic collectivism and the socialist thinking, that it is not an independent thing which it is now difficult to reconcile with the personal liberty on the one hand or the economic collectivism on the other. That on the contrary, the tendency to do things through political processes, through collective processes, inevitably leads to an overemphasize on narrow materialism, on the narrow economic arrangements, because the elementary fact is that the bulk of humankind is not concerned with much beyond the day's bread and the day's activity. Only small minorities are concerned with things that go much beyond that. And the only kind of climate in which that small minority is able to express those non-materialist ideas is a climate in which there is not too strong a central government or a central force or a central power. I do not think it's an accident at all that the socialist and communist countries of the world are the ones that are quite obviously and openly the most narrowly materialistic and the most narrowly concerned with the everyday, day-to-day, down-to-day activities. Similarly, a second point of equal importance. Irving stressed, and I agree 100% with him, the fact that you cannot have any kind of a stable society unless you have some common set of common values, unless you have he expressed it not in terms of common values but in the need on the part of institutions for legitimacy, that people, things will not be accepted simply because they are utilitarian. They must to some extent be accepted because they are thought to be right, because they do correspond to some basic values which attribute to those arrangements legitimacy. I think he is entirely right about that. I think he is also entirely right when he sees that this problem is more and more serious. He concludes from that we need to have a conservative society, as he defines it, and need to avoid a free enterprise and free society because we do not have a free enterprise and a free society will not have a sufficiently strong, a sufficiently broad, a sufficiently deep set of common values to enable it to persist. Now, once again, I would argue that the relationship is upside down. That while you need a common set of values, the question is how much do you need? How wide-ranging must be those set of values? How wide-ranging, how uniform those values must be depends on the kind of society you have. A collectivist society requires a much more extensive set of values and at the same time makes it more difficult to achieve them. It seems to me it is precisely the extent to which that we have broadened the role of the government, that we have broadened the use of political instruments, that to the extent that we have done that, we have simultaneously asked for a greater homogeneity of values and made it more difficult to achieve. And that a major reason why along that line you cannot have liberty in a free society is precisely because you undermine the common core of values. Let me illustrate this in a very concrete way, in a point which Irving raised, and I think is very important, the attitudes toward the corporation. A major factor that has been undermining two major factors that have been undermining the feeling of legitimacy of the corporation is, on the one hand, that it is in fact true that most corporations today drink very, very well from the trough provided by governmental activity and by governmental subsidies and privileges. There is hardly a private corporation today that is not heavily dependent upon government largesse. Because of the spread of collectivism, because of the greater economic centralism of control, the corporations are in large part semi-governmental units. They are not independent private enterprises that are allowed to go bankrupt. One of the great troubles is that we don't let corporations go bankrupt. That we think it not, nobody thinks it's surprising to see Penn Central come up and ask, or I should say the railroad industry come up to Congress and ask for $600 million as a one-year grant in order to enable them to become a thriving private enterprise. And the SST battle showed that as well. Those of us who were opposed to the SST were opposed to it. I was opposed to it, not on the irrelevant grounds about the ecology, which is mostly silly, but on what I thought to be the relevant grounds, that if this was worth building, it ought to be done by private enterprise, and there is no justification for government for a socialist movement in this area. All right, so on the one hand, the corporations are, in fact, becoming governmental entities, and as they become governmental entities, it is important, it is appropriate that the people who run them should be appointed in ways other than by the self-selection of the ownership of the corporations. On the other side, the businessmen listen to the collectivist philosophy that is so dominant. They believe it. They're in favor of socialism. They don't understand the role and virtue of a profit system. And so they are engaged in a major campaign to undermine the legitimacy of the corporations which they run. Now, Irving says correctly that that raises a problem for the maintenance of a free society. But I think he is wrong when he says that it also shows why free enterprise in a free society is not possible. Because I believe that the most effective way to reestablish the legitimacy of the corporation, the most effective way to enable the society to require only a small set of common values, is to dismantle the governmental activities, to reduce the scale of government, to have a larger degree of free enterprise in a free society. Now, I really don't know quite how to comment on his fears about the whole thing being killed by science and technology, the atom bomb in the basement. I suppose it's only innate optimism that leads me to look back on the course of history to all the other apocryphal predictions about how the world was going to come to an end fairly soon, and people isolated. I don't want to be isolated on top of a mountain like those people in India who thought the world was going to come to an end. I admit that Irving's fears have more base, far more base than those do. But I find it hard to know how to react to that except to say, well, we'll have to face that issue as it comes up. I must say, I find it impossible and intolerable to accept his opposition to change in the way in which he does. And the question I would ask of him, and the question I would ask of you, change for whom? If I don't want to have any change, I can resist change. I can go sit in my own place. If Irving doesn't want to read the latest newspapers, that's all right. I don't have any objection if he sits down with those old books or with the rerun. But if you talk about we ought to have a slower pace of change, I must say I find it very hard to swallow it. When what that means is those of us who are living pretty well are willing to accept a slower pace of improvement on the part of the well-being of those who are living much less, at a much lower level. I remember years ago having this argument with somebody whom I'm surprised to see Irving in the same group with, but who was arguing about how obviously this was on the Galbraith theme of the affluent society, and about how obviously everybody had enough consumption now and we ought to stop and look more at quality and quantity. And so I said to him, as I said to myself, I said, tell me, how much do you spend each year on your consumption? And then I calculated out that was about two to three times the average amount that the average American citizen was spending on his consumption. And I said, when the average of everybody else gets up to that, then let's meet again and talk about the fact that we're too affluent and that we don't need further economic development. Well, similarly, I really do find it hard to say. I know Irving expressed these difficulties, but I find it hard to see how anyone can argue that we should deliberately take measures which will slow down the possibilities of other people achieving what we have achieved. And I think the way Irving and I ought to come together on that is by recognizing that our present collectivist measures are doing precisely that. That the difficulties he's worried about, the turmoil he's worried about, come not from change, but precisely from the governmental arrangements that make it more difficult for other people to improve their lives. And that it is possible for us to have more of the kind of change he and I would jointly approve and less of the kind of change that he and I would not approve. For example, why do we have an overemphasis of advertising? You said we ought to do something about advertising. See, this is a good case. Every time one of these things comes up, there are two ways in which you can do something about it. One way is by having government do something else, and the other thing is by having government stop doing something. Now, Irving said he would be in favor of government imposing restraints on advertising.
I said just restraint.
Right.
I didn't say government.
Well, who's going to...
Anything that would diminish advertising.
Anything that would diminish advertising. Okay. Irving says, well, I'll give him something which will diminish advertising and which will promote change. And that's abolish FCC. We now have an obviously intolerable, undesirable situation in radio and TV in which advertising is being subsidized by the government in a major way, because it's only the fact that the Federal Communications Commission licenses TV and radio, controls the way in which TV and radio are used. It's that and only that which has enabled advertising to preempt the whole, almost the entire financing of radio and TV, and has eliminated, has made impossible the development of pay TV and of other means whereby you could have distributed TV and radio programs without advertising. All right, now, if we sold off, as many of us have suggested over the years, if we sold off all the radio and TV channels, converted them into private property, and abolished the FCC, then you and I would both agree that would be a desirable move. It would restrain advertising, but it would not interfere with change. On the contrary, it would make it easier and more possible for people to develop change. Now, I must say, with respect to the way in which the corporation needs to acquire more instruments of legitimacy, again, I think, I think that Penn Central will have much more legitimacy when it isn't being subsidized by the government and the railroads in general. I think that the various institutions that are being regulated will have more legitimacy when they're standing on their own feet. And this brings me to one other point I meant to mention earlier, and that was that very fascinating picture of the businessman's attitude toward bankruptcy, which seems to me to derive from a distinction that was less important in the 19th century than it is now, the difference between businessmen as individuals and corporations. And I think that one of the problems is the difficulty of attributing to corporations, which can't attribute to corporations, moral values. I think one of the problems with our present discussion and talk about GM being socially responsible is that it is another facet of the collectivist philosophy. Just as you say government is going to do something, when you and I as individualists and libertarians would want to say we're going to do something through a governmental channel, so people say corporations are going to do something. Corporations can't do anything, only people can do something. And people may do things through government. And so I think that the whole idea that there should be a morality applied to corporations is wrong. There should be a morality and values applied only to individuals. I've sort of wandered around a lot. I haven't said, and these have been sort of instant reactions to Irving's very provocative talk. I want to close by raising an issue that I hope somebody else will discuss, and that sort of doesn't come out of Irving's approach or my approach, but yet seems to me to be an extremely important feature of modern liberalism, 20th century liberalism as it's developing. See, just as Irving is reflecting doubts about conservatism as it was and about 19th century liberalism, so you are having changing attitudes toward 20th century liberalism. The liberals are getting very uncertain about centralized control. They are getting very uncertain about many of their favorite panaceas. But one feature of the modern liberal philosophy that I think is getting stronger and stronger and is causing more and more problem is the emphasis on egalitarianism. which doesn't really appear either in your discussion or in my discussion to date. And yet, if you ask yourself, what is the characteristic feature that dominates the discussion by today's liberals, I think you will find that the one feature that has emerged from their earlier faith and has become even stronger is the emphasis on pure egalitarianism. I have been very much impressed by that in one particular instance, which is what Christopher Jenks and his fellows at Harvard have been doing with the voucher plan. And they are just in the process of ruining a perfectly good idea, because they're going to insist that it shall under no circumstances be possible for any one person to have anything different from what any other person gets under. And this is almost a characteristic feature of the kind of reformist attitude of the modern liberal. And if there be anything which threatens individual freedom, see, this is inconsistent with their own emphasis in the past on individual freedom, personal liberty, free speech, and so on. Because they are almost, many of them, in the position where egalitarianism has to conquer over any other objective at any cost whatsoever. And I really don't know quite how this fits into this theme at all. I know neither Irving nor I would go along with it. We would both say what we want is equality of opportunity, of individuals to be free to pursue their own interests, provided they don't interfere with somebody else. And we do not necessarily want, in fact, we abhor a world in which everybody was identical. And in result, that would be about as dull a world as you can think of. Well, anyway, those, as I say, are some random comments, and I am grateful to Irving for having given me more than enough meat to chew on.